We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. For some time now, we've thought of grief as having five stages: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. They were named by psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Our guest this morning is journalist Ruth Davis Konigsberg. She first heard about Kubler-Ross's five stages in a high school psychology class. She says some 40 years after their naming, the stages remain firmly planted in our culture, showing up in classrooms, in newspapers, in television dramas and comedies, and in at least one work of art, a painting that sold for more than $2.5 million. Konigsberg also says of those five stages, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, they are myth. Ruth Davis Konigsberg is the author of a book that looks at what science has to say about grief. The title, The Truth About Grief, The Myth of Its Five Stages, and The New Science of Loss. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. You can join us with a phone call or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL, and the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Ruth Davis Konigsberg has worked as a reporter and editor. She has written for numerous publications, often about psychology. Her book, The Truth About Grief, The Myth of Its Five Stages, and The New Science of Loss, is published by Simon & Schuster. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and the email address will-talk@illinois.edu. Ruth, how are you this morning?
I'm fine, thank you.
And tell us what led you to this topic as a journalist.
Well, I, as you mentioned, I had been taught Kubler-Ross in high school, and it had sort of stuck in my memory bank, as it has, I think, with many Americans. After 9/11, I had been asked to look into a possible story about widows, young widows, and support groups for young widows. I wound up not actually doing the story because, understandably, the organizers of such support groups didn't want to let a journalist in, but I did come across a study that really stuck with me that basically showed that widows are a lot more resilient than we think. And this was work that was coming out of Columbia University, done by a clinical psychologist named George Bonanno, who's done a lot of subsequent work on resilience. So I actually wound up doing an article about that, about, you know, sort of the myth of widowhood. And as I was doing that article, the Journal of the American Medical Association published a study where researchers at Yale had taken Kubler-Ross's stages of grief and tried to actually validate them, and found that, in fact, people reach acceptance from the very beginning, as opposed to sort of that being the end point of the stages, and moreover, that instead of anger and depression, people experience pining more, which is really sort of missing and longing for the person. So I was sort of dumbfounded that it had taken so long for someone to actually try to validate this theory, which had been, you know, out there and had become so popular, and had also influenced treatment and grief counseling and everything else. So I was a little bit dumbstruck and wanted to really take a look at, well, how did this theory, how and why did this theory become so popular? And, you know, what have the effects of that been?
Yeah, those are great questions right there. Why have the five stages had such traction?
Yeah. Well, there are a number of reasons. You know, when the book came out in 1969, Kubler-Ross, well, it was actually the book itself, which I was not assigned to read in my high school class, but the book itself consists of interviews that she did with terminally ill patients. So from the very beginning, it was not about specific to grief. It was specific to losing a loved one. It was actually about one's own death.
Mm-hmm.
And the book itself deservedly caused ripples. It was, you know, it was coming at the end of a time period where people really were not grappling with death well, especially in the medical community. So it was a bestseller. The theory itself, you know, very quickly got sort of glommed onto not just grief but all sorts of loss. And she, Kubler-Ross, kind of encouraged that that sort of category creep. She, you know, basically it was not a piece of research. It was anecdotal interviews. You know, it was one-time interviews done with people. And she turned that into her theory. Now, the theory itself, I think, became very popular because it's sort of reassuring for people to know that there's a roadmap that they can follow. It gives clinicians something that they can use in treatment. You know, it makes intuitive sense. It certainly, you know, it doesn't go against the grain of sort of how we think of ourselves as humans and, you know, our emotional responses. So, you know, it's easy to remember. It's it gives you kind of like a, you know, an end point, a goal. So for all those reasons, you know, and I actually look in the book, I look at how stages in general have become so popular in sort of popular psychology and have sort of infiltrated the behavioral sciences and the appeal of stages in general. But I think for those particular reasons, the theory really gained traction.
Yeah. Well, Kubler-Ross wrote that book on death and dying, and then sometime later she wrote on grief and grieving. So,
that's right.
So was the blueprint for on grief and grieving on death and dying?
Basically, and I spoke with her co-author on grief and grieving. Kubler-Ross has passed away, but you know, I asked him. I said, well. Did you all do any additional research or any additional interviews, you know, with people who are grieving? And he said, no, you know, she really felt like grieving one's own death was the same as grieving the loss of a loved one. And he also said something very interesting to me, which was he said that he himself brought up the question of whether they should be calling these emotions stages. And he suggested that perhaps it should just they should use the word response, you know, that might be more accurate. But then he said, you know, we were both of the mind that the stages were so ingrained in the culture that there was no pulling them back in. So, you know, instead of kind of taking that opportunity to correct what had certainly become, you know, a cultural phenomenon, they wound up reinforcing it. Or reinforcing the myth, basically.
Yeah.
I thought that was very revealing. I mean, you know, I'm glad that they paused to think about it. I just wish that maybe they had, you know, taken another direction.
Yeah. That brings me to ask you now about a couple of arguments you make in the book. First, that guidelines for grief constrict our responses to loss, but at the same time, you say, as a society, we will most likely be unable to face grief without some kind of script.
Yeah.
So a couple of big questions here. How are we constricted, and how can looking at what science is learning about grief help us in the face of loss?
Well, that's a very good question. In terms of how we're constricted, what our approach and what this theory kind of gave rise to was a very strong emphasis on negative emotion. So, you know, for example, obviously, you know, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, those are all, you know, fairly negative emotions. And counseling, for the most part, also, you know, places emphasis on negative emotion. What we're finding, and the assumption is that you must express that negative emotion in order to heal. And what science is finding, what the researchers are finding, is that actually people who do not express their negative emotions are sort of healthier mentally, physically. They basically sort of fare better. And this is not, this doesn't mean that they are, you know, repressing things necessarily. It just means that sort of damping down those negative emotions actually has a protective function. So so I found that piece of research really fascinating, because I think that the more we can look at grief and bereavement and look at it just as combining sort of both the negative and any kind of positive emotion we can have, sort of a, you know, I mean, similarly to the way that people try to make memorial services celebrations of someone's life. They've also found that people who have lost a loved one, if they can kind of talk about their loved one with sort of positive affect and, you know, and get comfort from a happy memory, that they also do better. I don't have a particular solution, but I think that's one thing that we have ignored for, you know, for 40 years that can be brought into, you know, our approach. People are now looking at resilience and what makes someone resilient, and can we somehow, you know, how do we encourage resilience? It's kind of complicated because there's so many different factors that go into it. Yeah. But I think one aspect is a sort of this dispositional resilience. Mm.
This is Focus. Our guest this morning is journalist Ruth Davis Konigsberg. She is the author of The Truth About Grief, The Myth of Its Five Stages, and The New Science of Loss. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this morning with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu, will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's take a call. This is a listener in Urbana on line one. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call and for the interesting topic. I wanted to mention something that corroborates I thought an interesting way the statement about people who don't express their negative emotions, in particular the five, you know, that related to grief. I have a therapeutic writing practice, and I've found in my own research that there was a book called One Nation Under Therapy, and it was sort of a book that sort of described the negative impact of expressing negative emotions. And they did studies with people in, you know, after trauma, then the sort of quote-unquote support groups, in particular, like with breast cancer survivors and patients, where that was really true, that people felt sort of qualitatively worse after what the typical approach was, which was to sort of just express the negativity of whatever experience you're having. And so I'm really interested to hear this same incidence of that, you know, in a different context. And I'm excited because it really calls to clinicians and therapists and people in medical communities to kind of foster resilience and encourage resilience, and, you know, hopefully not in a superficial way, but really to sort of focus people's thinking and recollection and memory and speaking about negative experiences with some degree of, you know, this is not just a black and white negative or positive thing. This is the full spectrum of human emotions, and they're equally valid, positive and negative.
Absolutely, that's a great comment. And yeah, I've also sort of seen it in, if you look at, you know, some of the literature on depression, there's that also seems to be a component, this quality of rumination that people have, where, you know, they're basically sort of dwelling on the experience, the negative experience of having, of being depressed, and how that can predispose someone to a much longer, worse depression. I mean, so it definitely, you can see it sort of, you can see applications in lots of places, and certainly in trauma. I mean, certainly, you know, there was this whole theory about critical incident stress debriefing, where the idea was you have to get someone to relive the experience, you know, as soon the traumatic experience as soon afterward as possible. And in fact, that's not a great idea. So I think it's great. It's hard, you know. Clinicians and this whole field of mental health, you know, so many things change and there's so many shifts, and it must be very hard. I mean, it sounds like you're actually in the practice, so it must be very hard to have to, like, you know, accommodate all this new information that's coming out, and it does take a while to sort of trickle down into practice. But
that's why I find work like what you're describing, what you're doing, particularly exciting, because for somebody who, you know, really wants to be life-affirming without being a Pollyanna, you know, not wanting to deny full experiences, I find what you're doing and what you're describing and the research just really exciting and helpful. So I'll hang up and listen, but thank you very much.
Thank you for calling.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. Other calls are invited, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email will.talk@illinois.edu. Well, we've heard the mention of the word resiliency now a couple of times, and George Bonanno is interested in resiliency. How does he define resiliency?
Let's see, I might need a cheat sheet here, but
because it's pretty complicated.
I think his basic definition is sort of the ability to adjust within a, you know, sort of the ability to reach an acceptable level of adjustment within a fairly, you know, brief period of time, meaning, you know, weeks to maybe a few months. It's not like an instant thing. It's not like, you know, within 24 hours you're fine. Although you can see early on, like, signs of people who are going to probably have a resilient reaction longer term. So that's kind of interesting. But that's how he defines it.
And why are some of us more resilient than others?
That's where it gets so complicated. If only we knew.
Yeah.
No, it's there's so many factors, but, you know, some of it is about social support and resources, you know, money, financial resources. Some of it is about whether or not you've had previous trauma. A lot of it is also about whether you've had any kind of history, a previous history of, you know, mood disorders. But there's also this piece, and this is the part that I find so fascinating, that Tony Visconti, another psychologist, has kind of pinpointed as dispositional resilience. And that's something where we could actually kind of tinker with and influence. And it's basically sort of your outlook at the world. You know, it's whether you believe that the world is a just place, or whether you believe that everyone's out to get you, you know, whether you have sort of faith in the fact that you can cope with whatever it is that's coming down the pike. That's another part of it. I mean, these are the aspects of it that are sort of personality related that I find so fascinating. And again, suggest that you might be able to, you know, sort of either encourage a more resilient mindset in yourself, knowing sort of what those things are.
Yeah. It was a headline in a newspaper that led you to interview George Bonanno.
That's
good
right.
Grief. Spouses cope well. That was the headline.
Yeah.
What has he learned in the course of his work looking into the lives of bereaved spouses?
Well, he has learned, and his cohort, his like sample group, is mostly people age 65 and up, or actually the criteria was that your spouse or that spouse that you lost was 65 or older. So they may have been younger people, but for the most part, it was elderly. And also, it was spouses who died of natural causes. So those are sort of two important caveats. But what he has found is that most of the people, sort of stabilize by 6 months, and in fact, many do so much earlier. And by stabilize, we mean, that they return to sort of normal functioning. That they're, that this doesn't mean that they don't still miss someone, or that they aren't still sad, or they don't care, or any of those things. It just means that the kind of really core symptoms of acute grief have lifted by then, and that's just the normative response. That's the norm, statistically speaking. And then a smaller percentage of people have a much harder time, and he sort of breaks them down into subgroups. But so meaning that they get back on their feet sort of more about a year, 18 months, and then even further down the road. And those who take that much longer are now sort of being considered as people who might be suffering from prolonged grief disorder. So that's basically what he did, which was so kind of fundamental and sort of revolutionary at the same time, was actually look at, well, how many of us, how long does it take for us to get over this? How do most people do this? How do we live after loss? And what is the sort of normal, again, normative, what is the most common reaction? Because we have so many different cultural portrayals of grief, and we have so many different sort of societal expectations of grief, including gender ones, that it was impossible to know sort of what the normative response was.
Yeah, a couple of questions come to mind now.
Yep.
Why is 6 months a turning point?
You know what? That's when they measured it. I mean, it's not, it could have been much, it could have been earlier. Like they just couldn't, they simply couldn't, talk to everybody every week or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really have an answer to that. That just seems to be the sort of natural course, I'm afraid I come up blank with that one.
And then the other question, have differences been found in how male and female spouses grieve?
It's such a tricky question. I tried to tackle that. I devoted a whole chapter to that and basically concluded that it was really too difficult to tell, that the research was not strong enough. I mean, here's sort of historically what happened, which was in terms of the literature, was that historically it was mostly looking at women, almost exclusively looking at women, and also looking at clinical cases. So these would be the most sort of extreme cases. Then in the 70s, there were a couple of surveys that were also mostly looking at women. And I feel like some of those surveys gave rise to a double standard where, we kind of expect women to grieve harder and longer than men, and we encourage men to sort of move on more quickly and start dating and so forth. A couple of researchers in the Netherlands in the 90s looked at this question again about who grieves harder, or are there differences, and basically decided that it may seem as though women grieve harder, and some of the studies might actually show that they do, but if you control for the fact that women suffer depression more anyway, and you kind of take that out of the equation, you wind up finding that men actually suffer more. Again, in the end, I concluded that it's just too hard to tell. But some researchers basically say, men and women have much, much more in common in how we grieve than we do in any kind of difference. Yeah. And I thought that was really important to remember.
Yeah. One of the interesting things I think that George Bonanno told you was this: if you're resilient after a horrible accident or traumatic event, then you're a hero.
Yep.
But if you're resilient after a death, excuse me, then you're cold.
Yep.
In thinking about this, you know, as we are so interested and concerned about the people of Japan right now,
yep.
I see this, both of these threads in the narratives of the aftermath of the earthquake and tsunami in Japan.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's interesting. I think it also, I sort of feel like it also shows, and just the fact that they are being described as a resilient culture sort of shows how the concept of resilience is really has kind of entered more of the mainstream. And I am always wary of sort of, cultural, describing a culture with one word, but
mm-hmm.
just in the sense that obviously there's huge variety within a culture, within a subculture, you know. But I guess it also, you know, it's so early yet, that it's hard to tell. And in the case of many people there, they are, in fact, reacting to both things at once. They're reacting to a natural disaster. They're reacting to, and they're reacting to the loss of someone. So it is kind of intertwined in their case, certainly. So it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see, how they handle, the next couple of weeks and months moving forward. I mean, there's so many things that they have lost. They've lost their home. They've lost their livelihood. They've lost, maybe a person that they love. There's a lot going on there.
Yeah. This science of loss, as we're calling it now, what are the implications in instances of trauma, accidents, catastrophes that are natural or man-made, such as war? Is this going to be useful in terms of helping us through these experiences, which many of us will have in the course of our lives?
Yeah, useful in terms of what we might come to expect, or useful in terms of how people could help. I mean, there's sort of two different things, I guess, in terms of crisis and disaster and war and all of that, those sorts of things. I mean, I think what people have found is actually what people need in those times are logistical support, is logistical support and help. They need phones, they need food, they need, all. So this model, this idea that we've had that we should be sending in counselors, to various countries when disaster strikes, is hopefully going to go away. I mean, I think that it seems like it already kind of has. So that's one thing. Then longer term, it's sort of after the dust has literally and figuratively settled, then we can see who might, 6 months out, still be needing psychological support and counseling. But it's going to be a minority of the population. So that's important. I think that's what the science of loss, the sort of epidemiological aspect of it, can teach us, is not everybody needs grief counseling, not everybody, that the most important thing is other kinds of support before psychological support.
Yeah. Often when there's been some kind of trauma experienced, let's say in a school.
Yeah.
We'll hear as part of the reporting on the story, counselors will be available in the school the following day. And interestingly enough, this actually happened here within the walls of Campbell Hall a little more than a year ago now, when a great number of people were given terminal contracts. There were counselors on hand in the building, and I don't think that they got a workout.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh because that's actually a serious thing. But I think you're probably right. I mean, I after 9/11 here in New York, and there were thousands and thousands of counselors on hand, people were just not coming into the clinics. And that's a kind of a different situation, so maybe it's not analogous, but in the immediate aftermath, it's really hard to tell who might even need that. It's too early. It's too early. It certainly sounds like it's a nice thing for the university to have done, if that's in case, or whoever, organized that, the Human Resources Department or whatever. I would think that what those people need more than, a counselor is, some job leads, in that moment. So, and again, I might be misinterpreting that situation because I don't know all of the details.
In a situation where, let's say, a student or a couple of students have died in, let's say, a car accident, and grief counselors are available in the school. Can you tell us anything about that? I mean, is it something that gives us comfort to think about?
I think it probably helps administrators feel like there's something they can do. It's not a malevolent act at all by any means.
No.
It certainly comes from the desire to help and to do something, and equally the counselors themselves, are obviously doing this because they believe they can help people. The problem I have is just it's very hard to tell who might need help. It's too early, as I said earlier, and B, the counseling itself has not yet been proven to actually be effective, to make a difference. That's why I think we need to think about whether we should be doing that.
Mm.
Not that it's a bad idea, it comes from good intentions. It comes from a good place.
Yeah. One of the things that you write about in The Truth About Grief is how our ideas about grief, American ideas about grief, have been exported around the world.
Yeah.
What's the good, the bad, and the ugly about that?
Well, I thought that was so fascinating. And there's actually a fabulous book by Ethan Waters called Crazy Like Us, which came out about a year ago, that is generally about how our notions of mental health in general have been exported around the world, because Americans we produce the most research, we publish the most research. A lot of people come to school here to do their, to do their graduate level, degrees. So as I was researching grief specifically, well, first of all, Kubler-Ross was an international phenomenon, so her ideas did sort of spread far and wide, and so has our sort of American model for dealing with grief. And I focused in on Hong Kong and China because they offered such an interesting contrast, but in terms of cultural ways of dealing with grief. But at the same time, they were starting to offer grief counseling, very Western-styled grief counseling. And when I talked to one of the people who was actually offering this counseling and said, "Well, what models? What Chinese models are you using, or what for grief?" And he said, "We don't use Chinese models because there are no Chinese models, psychological models for grief." So sort of by default, they end up turning to our models. And again, a lot of these people have been trained, in the West, and then they sort of go back, or sometimes stay here, but often, then that's sort of how the exportation of the ideas happens. Often is through the teaching universities.
Hmm. Let's take a call. This is a listener in Tinley Park, line 4. Hi.
Hi. Good morning and good afternoon. I was wondering. First of all, I'm studying to be a counselor, so maybe I won't like the tenets of your book. saying we don't need as many counselors, the one thing that I was fascinated about reading or from listening to this interview is I wanted to ask what you think about what societal pressures have to do with the kind of counseling we receive, because I do think, you know, from studying and counseling, that there seems to almost be a certain pressure that if you don't go and get grief counseling or counseling because of certain traumas that you experience, that somehow you're repressing something. And I think in a lot of cases, I mean, just my opinion, a lot of cases, well, maybe people don't need it or it wouldn't be productive, but it seems like it's almost like society tells people that if you don't, you know, if you don't talk it out and if you don't go to counseling, then there's something wrong with you. You're engaging in some kind of repressive act to yourself.
Definitely. Well, first, I just want to say that I am actually a great believer in the mental health profession, and I don't, you know, I think counseling can be great for many, many things. But I think you're right. I think there is social pressure to see counseling. I mean, I kind of looked at this in a variety of ways. One of the ways that I looked at it was there was somebody who had done a survey about every story that it was in the New York Times from like 1970 to, you know, 2000 that mentioned grief and how, you know, where did they come down on in terms of counseling? And almost, I think, like 70 or 75% of them basically recommended some kind of counseling or quote or cited or quoted, you know, experts who were counselors and recommended counseling. So that notion has certainly been adopted, and I think part of it is what's called the grief work hypothesis, which is basically that, you know, we have to do something actively. We have to actively tackle our grief in order to heal. And if we don't, then it's going to come back and, you know, sort of bite us down the road. And that notion just kind of goes back to, you know, Freud and then one disciple of his in particular who wrote about the absence of grief and what that means and how you it's going to present, you know, psychological problems later on. So I definitely think there is social pressure. Although I've also, you know, talking to a lot of people who did lose people and who sometimes, you know, tried counseling and some of them liked it, some of them didn't, and I did find one woman who was quite resilient and had went to go see a therapist, and her therapist said, you know what, you don't need me, you know, which I think is great. Like, I mean, you know, a very, very honest and a good way to sort of assess whether or not someone would or would not benefit from grief counseling. So it's a stickier question for you than for me, you know, in a way, because you would have to grapple with that on a professional level. But I do think it's a phenomenon.
Does a listener want to follow up?
No, I think it's fascinating. I think you are so spot on with it, and I really appreciate the show and getting to listen to it, and I look forward to reading your book. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. What's been the reaction so far to the book from people in the mental health professions?
Well, it's been varied. There were some people. Some of the researchers have been very supportive of it because I'm kind of spreading news of their work, but also that I think they felt that for a long time this area, this field in particular of grief and bereavement, has been very disconnected from research. That research and practice was so far apart in terms of, you know, what people were believed in and were practicing, so that's been neat. I've even heard from people who are actually Kubler-Ross supporters who said, you know what, this is, you know, she wouldn't have minded this, and this is a good thing. But I, of course, have also heard from some people who I think have been upset by the way that I have challenged, you know, this particular approach to grief and questioned whether, you know, we need to broaden this out. I think the Association of Death Education and Counseling, for example, issued a statement saying that they were going to conduct a full scientific review of my book because they are upset about the conclusion that I came to, which came out of meta-analysis of studies that basically says, you know, we have not yet proved that counseling actually, works. So other than instances where people are having a particularly hard or prolonged reaction. So I've gotten the whole spectrum.
Do you think we're on the cusp of a change in terms of how we view grief? Do you see the five stages kind of fading away?
I don't know. I mean, they were so tenacious. I mean, what's been interesting is actually they had been sort of debunked in academia a long time ago, or at least questioned, you know. And most people, you know, who are researchers say, oh yeah, that was, nobody ever believed that. But in popular culture, they still are quite prevalent. So, I would certainly hope that we could reframe, our approach and think about it differently. And I hope that my book might encourage that, but I honestly, I think it may be too late. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. It'll be interesting to see.
Yeah. Well, if you put the five stages, if you just start to type that into a browser,
yeah,
you know, it finishes it for you.
Yeah.
And then boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
I was struck yesterday. I told my producer, Harriet Williamson, I just for grins wanted to, you know, see, you know, that's kind of a real quick and dirty way of gauging something. But there was an article that's appearing this week in The Economist about Americans going through the five stages of grief in terms of letting go of incandescent light bulbs.
Oh, my God. Yeah. See, then it's just... I mean, then it's just a metaphor, you know. I mean,
yeah, but, and it's kind of tongue in cheek, but you know, that's
but it pops up all the time. I mean, I say that Frank Rich has used it like five times in his column as a literary device. I mean, that's the problem, is it's gotten so divorced from even what it was originally intended to be. You know, now it's just as a sort of meme out there that people are, you know, turn to when they need something, you know, to frame, need a way to frame something. But it's used in that way. You know, it's used in that way all the time. I mean, maybe perhaps even more so than in a literal sense.
Yeah. Cookie cutter device.
Yeah.
Let's take another call. This is a listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hi. I'm sorry I missed the beginning of your program, but it is very interesting. I have a couple of questions and comments. Relevant to the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and so on.
Yep.
My son, at 6 years old, was killed 38 years ago.
Wow.
And we have done very well in dealing with that. Yet, it sounds like you're taking a very offhandish throwaway look at the whole Kubler-Ross thing, because what difference does it make to you if people go through that process, which in observational terms, you will see people doing that. And I for sure did that. But I didn't need Elizabeth Kubler-Ross to tell me that. That's what happened. in addition, when that happened to me, talk about resiliency. Who expects your six-year-old to be killed?
Yeah.
So you come from a point of you know, total, for me anyway, total non-information. There was a book called The Bereaved Parent by Harriet Sarnoff Schiff, and that book helped me more than anything else, because in her work, she didn't say counseling was not necessary. She didn't say she had done survey research. She just gave some suggestions on how and what people might do. I think that's much more of a helpful thing than to say whether or not someone needs counseling. In addition, I think we ought to be careful what we wish for. If, you know, if your medic analysis shows that people don't need counseling, I think it may have implications for people's long-term health care insurance. Right. People probably are too busy at the beginning of a tragedy to need counseling, but they probably do need it later. And they probably need their insurance, their health insurance or mental health insurance to take note of that.
Yep.
So although mine is a survey of one, I have worked, come across and worked with many people who have experienced this kind of grief. And, I'm a little skeptical about taking a meta-analysis and looking at survey research and coming up with a science of grief. One more comment. Emotional. This is all emotional reaction. And I think if you're going to do a research on emotions, it may be interesting to do some brain research on the amygdala and the ways that our body copes with emotional tragedy. That may give you a much better picture than just doing survey research.
Well, all good points, well taken and well made, rather. And, I think the caller certainly highlights sort of a tension between, it's sort of a classic tension between looking at, data, in the aggregate and the individual experience, which certainly, can be contradictory. So, and I also want to just be clear that I certainly don't mean that people don't need counseling. It's more just some might not. Most probably don't.
I agree with you. I agree with this business of sending that it's kind of superficial to send in a counselor when there's a tragedy, because most people need to be able to trust a counselor.
And, yeah.
If you're meeting them for one time, one shot, I agree with you. It's probably not very effective.
Yeah. But I'm sorry, your experience was quite some time ago, right? And I think probably back when you were going through this, there probably wasn't a lot available in terms of, resources or, you may have had I think things have changed a lot. I'd be curious to hear whether you think that's the case. I mean, it seems like there's a lot more support now.
The Bereaved Parent Society, I can't quite think of its name, was very active then and probably still is. I forget what they call it.
Compassionate Friends?
Yes. But I was relying on a friend very heavily,
yeah.
And I realized, thanks to her, that if I didn't get some help, I really was going to lose her as a friend because it was too much for her.
Oh, yeah.
And we did find someone who specialized in grief therapy, and it helped tremendously.
Yeah.
So I don't think we need to have a new career path, but I do think we need to have some people who can listen and can help.
I totally agree. I definitely, it's hard. It's like the tension between looking at an individual case and looking at the bigger, all of the data. Because even those meta-analyses that I mentioned, that doesn't mean that individuals have not been helped.
Right, and it doesn't mean that the five stages of grief are bunk either.
Well, that I feel a little bit differently. The harm there, as one researcher told me, is, the five stages are great for people who happen to experience those stages, but they are actually sort of stigmatizing for people who don't.
Oh, well,
and the problem is that, if you have a theory like the five stages of grief, the assumption is that it's universal, when in fact, A, it's not, B, the theory itself has problems. So in terms of counseling that's a much more sort of nuanced issue, but the stages, I feel pretty strongly, have not been terribly helpful for that many people.
Well, maybe that's so. I think, though, that perhaps qualitative research might give you much, much better insight than survey research.
And is that underway?
Is it?
I don't know. I'm asking.
Well, I don't know.
Qualitative? Well, I mean...
qualitative meaning interviews.
No, I know. I mean, that has always been going on. I mean, that has been the basis of, that has been the body of work, has been basically sort of anecdotal case studies.
Right.
And so that is ongoing. I mean, Banana right now is actually doing experimental studies on looking at resilience, which is for the first time actually kind of, you know, manipulating an environment to see what happens. And that makes it sound much worse than it is. It's not like he's manipulating these people at all.
I know that. But we have, you know, the University of Illinois had an institution called the Beckman Institute,
mm-hmm.
where lots of psychological and neuroscience research is being done. There may be some opportunities for those researchers
mm-hmm.
to actually get, if you want hard data, I mean, that's the kind of data you need to get. In the meantime, I think what we need to do is just be careful to make sure that people who are supporting grief, or are going through grief at any time, have, you know, a little workbook or handbook of what do you do?
That handbook will be so different for people. You know, that's why I think any kind of universal theory or, you know, anything about, you know, tasks or stages or things that you need to do is problematic.
Exactly. Not telling one what to do, but saying, this was my experience. This helped me.
Yeah.
Right.
That kind of thing can be more useful than, you know, either than, you know, but, to, you know, nobody's going to pick up a research study the day after.
Mm-hmm.
No. But they may call a friend. They may, friends, and doing the things that you said, you know, are, you know, the things that culturally do happen around the world in terms of support for people who died. One more thing.
I have to jump in now because we're out of time. We are really, we've pushed past the stop point here this morning, so we're going to have to wrap up. Very quickly, Ruth Konigsberg, any last thought you'd like to leave us with, 30 seconds or less?
Well, I do, when people sort of ask, you know, well, what is your advice, and this sort of gets mm-hmm. to the caller, what the caller was mentioning, I basically say, you know, my one piece of advice is that there, you probably already have what you need to get through this. And moreover, there is no, you know, one thing you should do, you know,
yeah.
like that's the notion that I am trying to dispel. Not that there might not be specific things that could be helpful, but there is no one thing that's going to be helpful.
There we've got to leave it. Ruth Konigsberg, thank you very much for talking with us this morning.
Thank you.
Ruth Davis Konigsberg is the author of The Truth About Grief, The Myth of Its Five Stages, and The New Science of Loss.